This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Mainland China tightens its grip on Hong Kong. Pro-democracy activists are afraid of what a new national security law will bring.
I'm talking to you, a foreign journalist. Are the police going to burst into my flat and arrest me?
I'm Marco Werman. Also, a film out today shows what the LGBT community confronts in Chechnya.
I wanted to ask you about the alleged abduction and torture of gay men in the Republic.
Это ерунда.
We speak with the film's director, and refugees in Greece see their housing benefits end.
The goal of the SDA is to empower people to move on their own. But when you lack the next step, then you just put them out in the street.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. The Chinese government is tightening its grip on Hong Kong. The mainland government today formally adopted a controversial new national security law. It's seen as an effort to stop this. Pro-democracy protests. For the past year, activists have taken to the streets of Hong Kong to push back against the control of Beijing. This new law will reportedly make any act of secession, subversion, or collusion with external forces a crime. Today, Hong Kong's chief executive Carrie Lam defended the law in a video address to the United Nations.
For those foreign governments or politicians raising objections to the legislation, one could only lament the double standards they are adopting. All those countries which have pointed their fingers at China have their own national security legislation in place. We could think of no valid reason why China alone should be inhibited from enacting national security legislation.
The move by Beijing brought a swift response from protesters. Hong Kong's highest-profile pro-democracy organization, Democisto, has disbanded. We start our coverage from Hong Kong. Emily Lau is a former member of the Legislative Council of Hong Kong.
As we speak, the law has not been published. We don't know the content. But the government said it's going to come into force. What a joke. We haven't seen it. We just don't know anything about the law. And it's been passed. It's going to come into force. They may start arresting people. And we haven't seen the content of the law. Have you heard of anything more ridiculous? Earlier today, the chief executive, Carrie Lam, spoke to the UN Human Rights Council, saying that everything will be all right. It would not harm human rights. And when she spoke, she had not seen the law. So I cannot think of anything more outrageous.
So very little detail, but there is a lot of concern. Are you worried about how strict the laws are going to be, or is your concern you don't know anything right now?
I mean, we've heard the four offenses: subversion, secession, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. But what would be the definition of these offenses? How many people would be caught, like me? I'm talking to you, a foreign journalist. Are the police going to burst into my flat and arrest me? They do that in mainland China with the dissidents, with the human rights lawyers. So if this law is going to be enforced in such a harsh way, it will blow away the cover of one country, two systems.
If you don't have the details on the law, though, how do you know that that would be the case?
We don't know. But we know how they deal with people who are suspected to be guilty of national security offenses in the mainland. That is not a secret. And the way they're dealt with is quite horrendous.
Well, Emily Lau, as you know, Washington is making moves to end Hong Kong's special trade relationship with the U.S. because they say if China's going to step in, well, then we can't do that deal. Is that a good idea?
There are 7 million Hong Kong people. And if the U.S. authorities, Congress, they really want to support the Hong Kong people, I hope they will think of a way to show the Hong Kong people that, oh, we are only targeting the authorities and not the ordinary people. It may not be easy, but I hope you can tell the difference. Because on the one hand, you say, oh, we want to support you, to help you. But then on the other hand, we will punish all of you in one go. And that does not make sense. We want the international community, including the US and Europe and elsewhere, to help to launch this lifeboat scheme to give Hong Kong people an emergency exit. Because there are those who are so terrified, who are so scared, they want to get out.
So the most prominent group of activists in Hong Kong, Demosisto, they've disbanded. There are other activists, though, who say they will march tomorrow. Will residents of Hong Kong dare to turn out, given the stakes right now with this law?
I think so. It would just take you a few hours to find out. There are people who will turn out, knowing that it would be against the law. So there are people who are still very courageous or very determined. I don't think they will resort to violence. But they will turn out to march because they think this is their human right. But they may be arrested because the police said you haven't got permission to march.
Are you going to march tomorrow, Emily Lau?
I will be joining my party. We are collecting donations in the streets tomorrow, and we will see what happens.
Emily Lau, a former member of the Legislative Council of Hong Kong, speaking with us from Hong Kong. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We also reached out to exiled Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. He spoke with us from Berlin.
This is probably the last nail of the coffin. This is mad. China ruthlessly just put its own law on Hong Kong. They don't care the West or the U.S. or Europe what they will respond to a situation like that.
So when you say this is the last nail in the coffin, what do you think that's going to mean for the people of Hong Kong, how they live day to day?
They will become another city of China, and they can secretly detain people, and they can be disappeared. And there's no argument in any judicial cases. So, of course, the rich people or the people can afford it. They were migrants to other locations. But the young people, the poor people, they all stay there.
In the current system, one country, two systems, how do you understand Beijing's attitude toward Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement? Why do they see it as such a threat if there are these two systems?
Actually, nobody really understands. No? I think if you look at the long strategy, China always have their own vision about Hong Kong and Taiwan. I think it's not really just about Hong Kong, but rather to really sending out the signal to Taiwan to say, they always think Taiwan is part of China. And I think that Taiwan is the next.
So Ai Weiwei, given that this very high-profile pro-democracy organization, Demosisto, has ceased all operations, I'm just wondering, what advice would you give to pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong right now?
It is very dangerous. Today, core players are already signed out. Many people are going to go underground, but the fight will always be there.
If those pro-democracy activists go underground, though, isn't that essentially the end of the movement, and the security law essentially puts China in charge in Hong Kong?
Basically, it's like that. It's a very sad story. You see how heroic last year. Millions of people walk on the street peacefully and demand some very small change. But none of those demands, the five demands, has been met. They are so arrogant. They never learn. I don't know what to say.
Ai Weiwei, your fight for democracy is also the long game. How are you feeling today?
I feel pretty sad. I feel the sky getting dark. And I feel Hong Kong is really very symbolic, which is the only possible Chinese world which has democracy, very professional, well-trained young people there, and they are very innocent. But the world, not only China, will punish them, but the world will also abandon Hong Kong. So that is a very, very sad story.
Ai Weiwei, thank you very much for your time and for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Ai Weiwei is China's most celebrated contemporary artist and a leading dissident. We reached him in Berlin. The global reckoning over police abuse is forcing a look at the policies that have allowed that abuse to exist. Like, when is it permissible for an officer to shoot someone or use pepper spray or a chokehold? There are international standards that answer those questions, but few countries follow them, in part because of resistance by officers. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
After the worldwide protests sparked by George Floyd's death reached France, the government there banned chokeholds, only to be met with pushback from police officers who held their own protests, where they symbolically threw their handcuffs on the ground. The Secretary General of France's biggest police union, Fabien Vachemerique, objected to the chokehold ban. He said systemic racism doesn't exist anywhere among French police. The government relented and reinstated chokeholds as acceptable use of force in some situations.
Going backwards and forwards is clearly not a good idea for anyone.
Stuart Casey Maslin is an honorary professor at the Center for Human Rights at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He says the reaction by police in France is a global phenomenon.
I think there is a genuine concern amongst many law enforcement officials that they are being asked to go out, risk their lives, and they're not being given the support and the backup from either their superiors or their political masters. But I also think it is easy to exaggerate that.
Police are better equipped and protected than ever before, he says. In recent protests, officers have incorrectly used non-lethal methods like tear gas and rubber bullets, harming people.
We've seen so many abuses that I think people have had to step in and make snap judgments. For the first time, prosecutors, legislators in a range of countries are being pressured to prosecute what they should have been prosecuting for many years.
They should have been, but they've avoided it for many years, Casey Maslin says, even when lawmakers had a blueprint they could follow. In 1990, the United Nations established global legal standards for use of force that protect human rights. These basic principles make clear that lethal force should only be used as a last resort, and only in two circumstances: when an officer is faced with lethal force, or when there's an imminent threat to someone else.
And there we're thinking about the suspected terrorist, the escaping serial killer, that kind of thing.
Casey Maslin says only 21 countries have laws that meet international standards, including Finland, Ireland, New Zealand, and the UK. The U.S. is not one of them. Claudia Flores heads up the International Human Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago. Her team recently published a study of policing in the 20 biggest U.S. cities. It found that Austin, Charlotte, and Denver have exceptions to the principle that lethal force should only be used in situations of lethal threat.
So this allowed the police officers to essentially use force on someone who presented no immediate threat to them, right? Someone who was actually just fleeing or someone who had committed a crime previously.
In contrast, Flores says in Finland and Norway, officers have to ask permission from their superiors before shooting someone. In Spain, they have to issue verbal cautions and fire warning shots.
So there are a number of other models that we could be applying in the United States that would ensure that police don't have as much discretion.
Despite these other models, none of the U.S. police departments Flores studied were in compliance with the minimum standards under international human rights laws.
So right to life, liberty, security, freedom from torture, freedom of expression and association, all of these fundamental rights that we claim to value in this country are being undermined by our failure to require police departments to justify use of force in a non-discriminatory way and in a way that actually respects the right to life.
In other words, if the U.S. and other countries around the world really believe in human rights, they should also care about meeting global standards for use of force. For the World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Coming up, a new documentary shows the struggles faced by LGBT people in the Chechen Republic. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Chechen Republic has been racking up human rights violations for more than a decade. But it wasn't until 2017 that the world understood just how bad things are for gay, lesbian, and transgender people there.
I wanted to ask you about the alleged abduction and torture of gay men in the Republic.
Это ерунда. У нас таких людей нету.
That's Ramzan Kadyrov, the leader of Chechnya, saying, "This is nonsense. We don't have such people here." It's from a new HBO film that documents the journey of persecuted LGBT people in Chechnya and tells the story of crisis workers who try to help them escape. It's called Welcome to Chechnya, and we're joined by the film's director, David France. David, situate us, if you would. Many listeners may have heard of Chechnya, but where is it and who governs it?
Chechnya is a republic of the Russian Federation. It's a very isolated place in the North Caucasus, surrounded by mountains, a little hard to get to. It's very insular in its culture. It's ruled by Ramzan Kadyrov, who was placed there and rules at the pleasure of Vladimir Putin.
Chechnya is controlled by Ramzan Kadyrov, the Kremlin-backed strongman. Chechnya continues to depend on aid from Moscow, enough to satisfy every whim of its erratic leader.
Ramzan Kadyrov is left to run this remote region of Russia by his own rules.
And he does so with a kind of an iron hand.
Right, an iron hand that's kind of critical to the whole story you're telling here. We'll get to Kadyrov again in a moment. What made you want to pursue this project, David, a film about human rights violations against LGBT people in Chechnya?
Well, it's a film about a multiple kind of basket of things, certainly about the atrocities that are taking place there, but also about how the world really paid very little attention to it, even once it was exposed. It was not sustained coverage, and once the coverage went away, the campaign against the community continued. And that's the third part of the story that really fascinated me, which was what the Russian LGBT community was forced to do on its own and in the shadows, in the absence of any sort of effective outcry or any sort of political pressure from the outside world, and certainly no hint of any movement toward justice inside the country.
So when the big headlines went away, you stayed on the story. And as you rightly point out, it's just as much about Russia as it is about Chechnya. One important character we follow throughout your film, we know him first as Grisha and then later learn his real name is Maxim. His story in many ways seems to be kind of the heart of your documentary. Who is he?
Well, Maxim was one of the scores or thousands of people, we really have no idea, who were rounded up and brought in because of their presumed homosexuality and beaten and tortured and most of them dispatched in one way or another.
Mm. And this is 2017.
This is early 2017. And they determined to their surprise that Maxim was not ethnic Chechen, but instead was in Chechnya working. He was from the north of Russia. So they let him go. But then almost immediately they felt that they had made a mistake, that in fact what they had done was to send him off to be able to tell the story of what happened to him in a way that would reveal what they're up to. So they began to pursue him. And so he went underground. They started putting pressure on his family, threatening to burn down their house, his parents' house, his sister's house, to kill his sister's children. So the whole family went underground and decided at some point that they couldn't live like that. And he, in an act of indescribable bravery, decided to become the first and only person to bring a criminal case against the people who abducted him and tortured him in the Russian courts. This is a huge move. Mm-hmm. No one else has come forward in this way, knowing that if they do, they put their entire families in danger.
I'm speaking with David France. He's the director of the new documentary, Welcome to Chechnya. So when we first meet Maxim, he talks some about the horrific torture that he was subjected to in Chechnya. He also talks about his first impressions of Chechnya. Let's hear this.
I like Chechnya a lot. You know, the people are great, their kindness and their readiness to help. I'm talking about ordinary people. And so when the gay persecution began, it was a huge shock for me. I couldn't understand how these kind people could treat others so violently, with such cruelty, to gay people who never did anything to them.
Maxim has a fairly good impression at first of the Chechen people, but then later in the film, after he and his family flee both Russia and the threat of Chechnya, Maxim's mother says this.
You know, we're fleeing the people, not the country. It's not the country's fault here.
So, David France, just to be clear, the voiceovers we provided, your film is subtitled, but those two perspectives, they convey seemingly contradictory ideas about what Chechnya is. How did you kind of square them?
Well, the thing about the Lapunov family is that they have a great understanding of humanity, and they're very generous in their worldview, but they're realists. I mean, their lives have been permanently uprooted. They are hiding, moving from place to place through Europe as their court case proceeds, because they know that they have drawn the fire, not only of the Chechen government, but also with the Russian government in general, that really does not want attention brought to this matter. And I think that when Maxim's mother speaks about individual power-thirsty men, she is really speaking a truth about what's happening in our world today.
David, what is the latest on Maxim's case?
Well, Maxim pursued the case through the courts in Russia, and it was rejected time and time again, and he moved the case into the European courts. So his case now rests in the European Court for Human Rights, where it is being investigated and pursued. They are waiting now for Russia to respond to the charges and the preliminary findings of the investigators.
The big goal for the extraction of these LGBT people in Chechnya is asylum, seeking asylum in Europe, the U.S., Canada. Canada seems to be the destination for a lot of these asylum seekers. What have you learned about asylum for LGBTQ people while making this film?
Asylum seeking and refugee declarations for the community are complicated, more so than many other groups of people who are seeking protection and safety elsewhere. They're not overtly protected by most governments. And so it's been quite difficult for the activists on the ground to find partners in the foreign offices of most governments around the globe. The U.S. has taken nobody that has petitioned since this tragedy has been revealed, nor has the U.K. Mm. We're in a time now globally where xenophobia is on the increase and paranoia about immigration has reached a peak. It becomes a burden that is a lasting one for the activists. They bring people in now into their shelter network, into their underground, and they can't get them out.
Yeah.
There they are stuck, and it becomes an impossible situation, impossibly expensive, obviously, to keep people hidden in large numbers throughout Russia and elsewhere. So, one of the things I hope the film will point to is how tough it is for the LGBTQ community to make their way out of this hostile world. It's really a pressing and very urgent problem.
That's director David France speaking about his new film, Welcome to Chechnya. It debuts tonight on HBO. Join the conversation about the stories that keep you thinking and connect with our team of journalists bringing you those stories. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. The International Song Competition, Eurovision, was canceled this year, but at least Netflix has brought us fictional contestants.
All right, everyone. This is Secret. We are Fire Saga.
Who wants to hear Eurovision song?
Now the real song recorded by these fake singers is sweeping the Eurovision universe. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. In Greece, tens of thousands of asylum seekers from places like Afghanistan and Syria are stuck in overcrowded camps, waiting for their applications to be processed. The people considered especially vulnerable have gotten housing and other services as they wait for their cases to be decided. That's done through an EU-funded program called Estia. But a recent change to the program means thousands of refugees could soon end up on the street. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
When Bori Alhaidi and her four young kids got on a boat in Turkey to make the treacherous journey to Greece a few years ago, they had virtually no other choice. They are Yazidis, a religious and ethnic minority from Sinjar in northern Iraq. In 2014, ISIS launched what the UN now calls a genocide against Yazidis, murdering thousands. Alhaidi says her own husband was kidnapped by ISIS. She still doesn't know if he's dead or alive. Alhaidi told me her story from the small apartment where she lives with her four kids. It's 10 minutes outside of Thessaloniki, the second largest city in Greece. She gets this apartment through Estia. She qualified for the EU-funded program because she's a single mom and because of mental health issues she said she's developed since her husband's disappearance. As part of the program, the family also gets a 400 euro monthly stipend. That's about $450. Al-Haidi says they barely get by, but the housing and stipend helped as the family went through the asylum process. This month, though, the payments stopped coming, and Al-Haidi was told she'd have 30 days to leave her apartment by July 1st. That's tomorrow. More than 6,000 others face the same deadline because of new rules set by the Greek government. It says that spots for Esthia are limited and that it wants to make room for asylum seekers waiting out their applications in camps on the Greek islands and elsewhere. I visited one of these camps back in March. Moria on Lesbos Island is severely overcrowded. Some 20,000 people, many of them children, live there. The place was built for about 3,000 people. The small makeshift tents people sleep in are practically stacked on top of each other. There's mud everywhere. Conditions are unsanitary. So we're passing over a little bridge at the camp, and underneath there's just trash everywhere. The Greek government says it wants to move through asylum requests more quickly and that it wants people who qualify to wait out their applications in more humane conditions, which is why earlier this year they changed the rules. Once people get asylum, they now have 30 days to leave government programs like Esthia. Before that, they had 6 months. This is why Al-Haidi, who does have asylum, was given 30 days to leave. In a TV interview earlier in June, Greece's migration and asylum minister, Notis Mitarakis, said the government doesn't have the capacity to give housing, a stipend, and other services to people applying for asylum and to those who already have it.
Δεν θέλουμε από την άλλη να γεμίσουμε την Ελλάδα δομές και να φιλοξενούμε ιδρυματοποιημένους αυτούς που πλέον δεν δικαιούνται.
He suggested that the program is being abused by people who no longer qualify for it. He said that there are thousands who got asylum last year and the year before, but ignored the previous six-month grace period and are still getting the perks. Al-Haidi says she got her asylum back in 2018, but she says she wasn't aware of any rules that she had to leave after 6 months, so she stayed. Zoe Kokalou is with Arsis, an NGO that works with asylum seekers in the Esthia program. She agrees that something needs to be done about the more than 35,000 people living in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions on Greek islands. These migrants, she says, need to be taken away from the mud, the makeshift tents, the trash, the unsanitary conditions, and be put in a safe environment.
Όμως δεν είναι το σχέδιο σωστό να βγάλεις τους ήδη ευάλωτους.
But forcing those who are already vulnerable out of state-funded accommodations is not the way to go about it, she says. Lefteris Papagiannakis agrees. He's with another NGO, also involved with the Esthia program. It's called Solidarity Now. He says Esthia was always meant to provide temporary relief to asylum seekers.
The goal of the Esthia is to empower people to move on their own. But when you lack the next step, then you just put them on their own out in the street.
Papagiannakis says the Greek government doesn't have a solid integration plan for recognized refugees to help them get jobs, long-term housing, to learn the language. A struggling economy and the impact of the pandemic don't help. And he says the fairly new government, which came into power last summer, has taken an increasingly anti-migrant stance.
Greece has never worked with doing integration before. Now it becomes increasingly difficult because the policy of the government changed, the narrative of the government changed. It became more toxic.
Integration, he says, requires the cooperation of Greek society. They need to employ refugees, rent out apartments to them. But people are less willing to do that in this environment.
Because when you demonize refugees and then you ask from the whole society to show solidarity, it sends mixed messages and people react. It makes complete sense. The same thing happened in Hungary, the same thing happened in Poland.
In France, and to some extent in Germany, he says. As for the Esthia program, Papagiannakis says he doesn't buy that the government has migrants' best interest in mind. He points to the fact that just this month, the government said that it was slashing 30% of the budget for the program.
It is all being done with an end goal to deter people from coming, making things difficult in order for people to be deterred.
Deterred from coming and deterred from staying. We reached out to the Greek government for an interview, but they didn't get back to us. In the meantime, thousands of refugees are waiting to see how the new rules will be enforced. More than 6,000 are at risk of being evicted, and that number will keep growing every month. Boreal Heidi and her four kids are supposed to leave their apartment by tomorrow. She says she hasn't been able to get any sleep, doesn't know what's going to happen next. She does know that she doesn't want to stay in Greece. When she and her kids get the right travel documents, she wants to leave, to try to go to Germany and reunite with some family members that have made it there. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
There's a disturbing and somewhat confusing story out of Iran today. A court in Tehran has sentenced a journalist to death. Rahala Zam is accused of using a messaging app while in exile in Paris to stir a political dissent in Iran in 2017. He was arrested in Iran almost 9 months ago. The court found him guilty of the charge of corruption on earth. Hadi Gaimi joins me to help explain the case. He's executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran, joins us from New York. Hadi, tell us who Rahala Zam is and how well known is he in Iran?
Rahala Zam is very well known, or became known, over the past 4 or 5 years in Iran. His father was a political elite. He grew up in the same circles as the ruling elite. He left the country about 10 years ago and started activism and dissent against the regime. Eventually, he was somehow taken back to Iran, charged, prosecuted, and now being sentenced to execution.
So did you follow his channel on the messaging app Telegram? Like, what was he doing and saying that earned him the ire of the Iranian regime?
Well, he left Iran around 2010, 2011, and he came with a lot of connections within the regime, and especially of the workings of the judiciary, publishing details of bank accounts held by the chief of judiciary. There were a lot of money in it, and the question was, what is he doing with that money? He also revealed many other corruption cases and generally was very passionate in promoting protests and street uprising in Iran in the past few years.
Earlier you said somehow he ended up back in Iran, and it is an odd sequence of events. He'd been living in exile in Paris, as I said. What do we know about why Rahala Zam was in Iran in October of last year?
There is a lot of uncertainty, but what we do know for sure, especially from his wife who remained back in Paris, is that he did not go back to Iran willingly. He was deceived while he was abroad, most probably in Iraq, by Iranian intelligence into meetings where he was kidnapped and taken back to Iran.
He was on Telegram showing protesters how to build gasoline bombs. It wasn't all kind of justice and dissent. Was he naive, or was he determined to really antagonize the Iranian regime?
Well, he was determined to antagonize the regime, and that's probably a big mistake he made in so explicitly advocating for violent confrontation between protesters and security forces. But in general, it still doesn't mean that he is qualified to be sentenced to execution.
A death sentence seems really harsh. Do you expect Iran to carry it out?
I am extremely concerned in the way Iran has been carrying out death sentences in the past few months, which is not getting much attention. And now we see increasing number of death sentences issued like Rahala Zam. We've had a wave of execution and execution sentences against protesters and political prisoners. And that worries me because it is a hark back to the playbook of the judiciary in 1980s, where tens of thousands of people were put to death to consolidate political power. And I think the regime falls insecure today and is starting to play the same rules to intimidate and control the situation.
Hadi Gaimi, the executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran, speaking with us from New York. Hadi, thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you.
The numbers are not getting any less staggering. More than 10 million confirmed cases of coronavirus in 188 countries. More than 500,000 people have lost their lives. The global search for a vaccine is underway, including in South Africa. Nearly a quarter of all COVID-19 deaths in Africa occurred in South Africa. And a new clinical trial was launched there last week. The World's Halima Gikandi brings us that story.
When Nosisi Nkiba went to the doctor last week, she says it was like a normal visit. The 55-year-old lives in Johannesburg. She sat on a bench, the doctor swabbed her arm, then gave her the injection and put a Band-Aid over it. But Nkiba was sent home with very specific instructions.
Every day you take your temperature.
you check your high blood, you check everything so that you can explain the after effect of a vaccine.
The vaccine she was getting was not for the flu or yellow fever. It was for coronavirus. And Kiba is participating in a new clinical trial for a COVID-19 vaccine. It was developed by Oxford University in England, where testing began in April. Last week, the first phase of the same trial was launched in South Africa. It will be looking at whether the vaccine is safe for healthy patients. That's why Nkiba is on the lookout for warning signs.
Swelling, shortness of breath, cough, loss of sense of taste, weakness, tiredness, headaches, joint pain, muscle pain.
The University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, also known as WITS, is running the trial. They plan to enroll 2,000 participants. The same vaccine will also be tested in Brazil. Johnny Malango is a professor at WITS University. He says it's critical to have these clinical trials in different parts of the world.
With many of these studies, one might find either environmental differences or even genetic differences in the various populations in Africa. And that's what makes it particularly important that we participate in the studies.
In other words, vaccines might not work in every population in the same way. In fact, the clinical trial in South Africa is uniquely tailored to its own population. It includes participants with HIV.
That is a very important design, given that HIV in South Africa is a challenging environment where there's a large number of patients who are currently either treated or walking around with HIV.
The original vaccine trial in England has already moved on to other phases. Now it's testing whether the vaccine actually works against COVID-19. Malangu says the early data is a good sign that the vaccine is safe. But of course, there are still risks. Those aren't lost on Nosisi and Kiba. I asked her why she decided to take part in the trial. She says she's really doing it for her 3 children and 3 grandchildren. And Kiba says this pandemic is killing a lot of people, and she wants to help stop it.
Maybe by risking, I might help, because this COVID-19, it's killing. And it was very hard to take this vaccine, but I tell myself, God, give me strength.
Nkiba will receive one more injection of the trial vaccine in a month's time, but the clinical trial in South Africa could take a year. It's clear that African countries don't want to be left out of the research process. Last week, the African Union held a 2-day conference on vaccine development. John Nkengasong directs the Africa Centers for Disease Control. During a recent press conference, he said African countries need to be part of the search for a viable vaccine.
Africa cannot just be a passive participant in this. We have to be an active participant by taking part in both phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials.
That includes manufacturing and producing coronavirus vaccines in African countries once they're proven to be effective. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
6 decades ago, hard-fought independence took hold across Africa. 16 countries severed ties with France and Great Britain in 1960. And on this day that year, Congo gained its freedom from Belgium.
Je vous demande de faire de ce 30 juin 1960 une date illustre.
Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba urged the Congolese to remember this illustrious day, June 30th, 1960, in your hearts.
Nous avons connu les ironies.
He directed sharper comments to the Belgians in the room. We have known ironies and insults, he said. We were subjected to beatings morning, noon, and night because we were black. That evening, Congolese across the country spun a song just for the occasion, Independence Cha-Cha by Le Grand Calais. It told the story of how disparate groups across the country came together to reject Belgium. The song should have been a harbinger of great things to come, but less than a year later, Lumumba was overthrown and killed in a coup, organized in part by the United States. 50 years later, Congolese rapper Balo G revisited the song. He called his version Le Jour Après, the day after independence.
Promesse le lendemain, promesse de l'aube d'un état souverain, où le sol se dérobe entre milices et rebelles, brillage et recèle, peuple que l'on déplace comme des cheptels.
Balogi rapped about all the great things Congo hoped for that day. Then the lead singer explains what went wrong. The day after independence, he sings, the clock stopped. Justice sank underwater. 60 years on, the critique still applies. Today, though, a historic gesture. In a letter, Belgian King Philip expressed deep regret for the suffering and humiliation inflicted on Congo during its 75-year colonial period. For the first time, contrition from the colonial power.
Cette chanson fédératrice, symbole de la crédulité des prémices, entre indépendance et armistice. Mais pour que nos démocraties progressent, pour qu'elles apprennent de leurs erreurs de jeunesse, mon pays est un continent émergent, bâti en moins de 50 ans.
I'm Marco Werman, you're with the world. Earlier this year, we introduced you to an 18-year-old named Iscan Ordaz of Texas. He's a first-time voter and part of our series Every 30 Seconds. That's how often a young Latino in the U.S. turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. Reporter Stella Chavez from KERA in Dallas caught up with Ordaz and brings us the latest on his story.
A few weeks ago, Iscan Ordaz joined his high school classmates to march for Black Lives. A few days later, he marched again, this time with people of all ages on the streets of Keller, an affluent Fort Worth suburb not usually known for protests. Just like in many places across the country, residents here turned out in larger numbers than expected. Keller police estimate 3,000 people showed up.
I really assumed it was just going to be mostly young people, mostly a lot of minorities. But when I got there, I found that it was predominantly, you know, just white Americans and lots of older families, lots of children.
Iscan felt compelled to do something after watching the video of a white Minnesota police officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd, a black man. He says what happened to Floyd wasn't right and was painful to watch.
I think as young people living in the United States, it really is our job to start to step up and to really make the future of the United States go in a different direction.
Iscan says it's his generation's responsibility to prevent mistakes previous generations made. But he also thanks those generations for paving the way in the fight for racial equality. He knows about high-profile cases like the protests that erupted in the 90s in Los Angeles after four police officers who'd been videotaped beating black motorist Rodney King were acquitted.
This police brutality has been a recurring issue in the United States that hopefully by the time we get to our parents' age will not still be an issue.
And this generation could make that happen.
What we're seeing today is an exciting protest movement.
Max Krockmal is a historian at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. He says this current social movement has learned from the civil rights movement of the 60s. That movement pushed the country as far as white Americans were willing to go, Krockmal says. In the 60s, black activists marched and demanded equal rights. And eventually won access to places like restaurants and movie theaters. President Lyndon B. Johnson then signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But the movement hit a roadblock, and in some ways, Krockmal says, he feels like the nation has moved backwards.
So I see the current Black Lives Matter movement as picking up that torch, right? As saying that the things that the nation identified that were wrong in the wake of the last wave of urban rebellions are still wrong.
Krockmal says the country still needs to deal with underlying issues of racism.
But there's hope now.
What we're seeing right now that I think is amazing and remarkable is that young people are out in the streets for the first time ever. They are themselves making history.
Iskan feels that too. He believes his peers are more tolerant and accepting of others. Iskan uses his name as an example of that tolerance. The name Iskan comes from the Aztec language Nahuatl and means behold. He says he used to feel self-conscious about it, but at school, he's actually gotten compliments.
The bottom line is that Generation Z as a whole does not agree with racism. It is not a political issue. Young people are normally the ones that stand against racism when it happens from older generations.
Iskan's mom, Xochitl Ortiz, says she's proud of her son for standing up for issues he believes in. Sitting outside her home one recent evening, she reflects on that.
My husband and I are just amazed that he's able to articulate and just really see at his young age the ideas that he has.
Ortiz and her husband don't shy away from talking with Iskan about a number of difficult topics, like racial disparities, discrimination, and the history of slavery. And she accepts the fact that sometimes they may have different views on issues.
It's just really neat to see how he kind of takes in information and doesn't just quickly jump to make a decision, but really kind of investigates.
Just what impact this new movement will have on the ballot box in November remains to be seen. As for Iskan, he's still somewhere in the middle politically, more conservative than his parents, but not too far right. He believes in capitalism and a free market economy. But President Trump's response to recent protests have made him even more critical of him.
I personally feel that the role of any leader, anywhere, anytime, should always be to try to create some kind of unity with the people that he's hoping to lead.
For the world, I'm Stella Chavez.
Finally today, the international singing competition Eurovision was canceled this year because of the pandemic. If this bummed you out, I want you to meet Lars and Sigrid.
Ever since we were children, we've had one dream.
Winning the Eurovision Song Contest.
Okay, Lars and Sigrid are not real. They're characters in a new Netflix movie. Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams play a washed-up Icelandic duo called Fire Saga. This fake duo put out a real song called Volcano Man. Well, now, wouldn't you know it, the song has caught on and real Eurovision musicians are covering it. An acoustic version from 2016 winner, Ukrainian singer Jamala.
Wake up at night, I heard a floating chorus. They guide me to their highland floors.
Estonia's 2018 contestant Elina Nechayeva went full opera. And the winner of Eurovision 2009, the Belarusian-Norwegian violinist Alexander Rybak, layered in some strings. Eurovision, glad to see you're keeping it weird. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.